I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, the West Texas measles outbreak continues to spread with a growing number of cases and an additional county. In Gaines County, there's been at least 24 cases reported. Most of them are unvaccinated school-aged children. Texas does allow children to avoid being vaccinated by claiming exemption for reasons of religious belief. Gaines County has one of the highest rates of exemptions in the state, and officials are stressing that this measles outbreak is likely to continue to spread. Meanwhile, flu cases in Texas are spreading. According to the CDC, Texas is one of the top states for a surge in flu cases, and COVID numbers are also climbing back up. What is happening with the spread of infectious diseases? This is a community conversation. We want to hear from you. Call in at 833-877-8255. That's what's coming up on The Source, but first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Infectious diseases are having a moment right now, and we can expect things to get worse before they get better. There's a growing measles outbreak in West Texas. Influenza activities on the rise in Texas. It's been reported that there have been 64 influenza-associated outbreaks during the first week of February. Texas is experiencing an increase in COVID-19 cases. It's been confirmed that there's a 50% rise in cases and 78% increase in COVID-related deaths recently. And the H5N1 avian influenza virus has been detected in dairy cattle in Texas, marking an unusual cross-species transmission. A dairy worker in Texas has become infected. And a stomach virus, a norovirus, is reported to be in circulation in the area as well. To find out what is happening with infectious diseases, we're joined by Dr. Jason Bolling, University Health Director of Hospital Epidemiology and Professor of Infectious Diseases at UT Health San Antonio. And Dr. Jason Bolling, welcome to The Source.
Hi, Dave. Thanks for having me.
So let's talk first about what's happening with the outbreak of measles in West Texas. We know that this is an area where they have a very low vaccination rate. So what can you tell us?
Sure. So we know that measles is really one of the most transmissible viral pathogens out there. And we actually use it as a model oftentimes for a formidable transmissible pathogen. There's about a 90% attack rate. So if someone is susceptible, hasn't been vaccinated, and they're exposed to measles, there's a 90% chance they'll develop measles. And so it's really key, because we don't have treatments after people are infected, that we get as many people vaccinated as possible to really prevent transmission of this. And so the lower vaccine rates in different areas of Texas and the country put us at risk for potential measles outbreaks.
It's unusual that this is happening in West Texas, Gaines County, which is right on the New Mexico border. Texas has very lax exemptions. People who don't want to be vaccinated in Texas basically don't have to be. And if they go to schools, they can claim a religious exemption. They don't have that in New Mexico. It's much tougher there. And we can really get a good idea of what the impact of those exemptions are having, because there's only one reported case of measles right now in New Mexico, near the Gaines County, and we're seeing numbers just really exploding in the Texas side of the state border. Does that mean anything to you?
I think it highlights that the vaccines are really effective for measles, which is important, again, because of how transmissible it is. We've made a lot of progress with reducing and eliminating some of these vaccine-preventable diseases, but if we get complacent, there's always a risk that they could come back. And so it does highlight the importance that we get as many people vaccinated as we're able to do so.
They're having vaccine clinics now in Lubbock, nearby Lubbock, drive-through clinics. So the vaccine is a weakened form of the virus. Is that too little, too late?
It's not too little too late. I think it's still helpful to get people vaccinated. Ideally, you want to have two vaccines on board, but getting even that initial vaccine provides a fair level of protection. It's estimated around 93% protection with the first vaccine. The vaccine was licensed in 1963, and we saw a significant decrease in measles in the United States. And then in 1989 is where it was recommended that you get a second dose, and that brings that protection up to 97%. So it's important to help stem this outbreak or prevent further cases in people that are susceptible by even getting that first dose in. It will provide some protection and hopefully decrease the increase in cases.
Well, we should touch on how serious measles can be. People disassociate it. So, you just get some freckles and you run a temperature for a few days and then you'll be back to normal. We are seeing hospitalizations in West Texas because of this outbreak. How serious is measles?
Right, so it can run kind of a range, and the more cases you have, the more you're going to see more in those different categories. But you're right, some people it's a milder disease, but in other cases it can be fairly severe. The most common complication is diarrhea, but then second to that really is pneumonia. And people, especially in children less than 5, can get pneumonias and end up hospitalized for that. You can get secondary bacterial infections because your immune system gets suppressed when you're battling measles. And then about 1 in 1,000 people that get measles can develop brain involvement. It's called encephalitis, and they can have some serious long-term sequelae from that, and they can even potentially die from that.
It's interesting that Gaines County is really a low population county. It has about 24,000 people in that county, and yet they have 24 cases of confirmed cases of measles. That's a lot, and it's really a lot when you think about the ratio of people that live in the county.
It sure is, and it reflects to what you mentioned earlier that the kind of the higher rate of people that have not received the measles vaccine. I believe they had about 14% of students aged kindergarten through 12th grade had not been vaccinated in the school district there. If you look at the San Antonio average for kindergartners, it's really closer to like about right under 95%. So, 95% versus 86%. So that decrease is significant when you're dealing with something as transmissible as measles is.
So, should we be doing anything locally, making the measles vaccine available, having our own clinics?
At this point, I don't know that we need to stand up additional clinics, but I do think it's helpful to provide information as you're doing, reminding people of the importance of getting the vaccines. It's important that if people have questions, which is understandable, that they go to credible sources to learn more about the vaccine, but really recognizing that even though we haven't had a lot of measles and it's considered eliminated in the United States, that status is always in jeopardy if we don't get enough people vaccinated every year.
The measles vaccine is known to be one of the safest vaccines that we have. Does that get lost in the mix? We need to highlight that.
I think that's a really important point. And also the fact that you don't have to continue to get recurrent vaccines like you do with some of the other vaccines that we currently have. The measles vaccine, it's 2 doses, but then most people will have really lifelong protection from the measles vaccine after that. And it's been around, as you mentioned, it's one of the safest vaccines. And we know that because we've had it since the 1960s.
Well, these people like me, grown adults, do we have to worry about the fact that we got that vaccine so many decades ago?
So at this time, there really isn't a recommendation to have to get a booster dose or re-up. It's something that can be considered if we were to start to see really, really widespread outbreak. But at this point, really, people are probably still protected, which again speaks to the importance and the efficacy, really, of this vaccine.
So, measles was declared eradicated from the United States around 2000. Here we now are seeing now almost seasonal outbreaks of measles. Typically, they really gets bad in March and April. Should we expect what's happening in West Texas to continue to increase?
So it will likely increase some, again, because of how transmissible measles is. Part of it will also depend on how many unvaccinated or susceptible people are available to continue the transmission. It really highlights that it was declared eliminated in 2000, but again, that status is always in jeopardy if we don't have enough people protected or vaccinated.
We're going to take a break here. We're going to continue talking about infectious diseases, COVID is back up. Influenza is way up. We're going to be talking about that. And also, I've got Ben is on the line. Ben, I'm going to get you on the air with your question. If you got a question or a comment about what's happening with measles in West Texas, locally with the flu and COVID, give us a call, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Source continues after this break.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp carrier dedicated to handling claims proactively and a commitment to helping injured employees and workers' comp policyholders get back to business. TexasMutual.com/claims.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. With me, Jason Bowling, a doctor, University Health Director of Hospital Epidemiology, Professor of Infectious Diseases at UT Health San Antonio. We're talking about spread of measles, the flu, COVID-19, all sorts of things are spreading right now. What can we do about that? What do you need to know? How reliable is information out there these days? You can give us a call. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. And we have Ben. Ben, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Good morning, gentlemen. Good afternoon. You know, with all these people coming in, you know, from different countries, are they getting vaccine? Are they getting their injections, their shots?
All right, Ben, thank you for the question. So what do we know about the people who come into the country? I'm not sure which people he's talking about. We have a lot of international travel. Of course, there's always the conspiracy theory that we have people who are in the country illegally spreading diseases. That's an old trope. But Dr. Bowling, what can you tell us?
Well, I think you're right. There are processes for people that are applying and coming through the country, refugees, where it's their medical history is reviewed. We know that there are different resources available globally. And so there are differences in how many vaccines people might have received based on where they're coming from. And so people coming, even just traveling that have been vaccinated, are at risk, depending on where they're traveling to, getting different types of infections. And so it's an important consideration. Really shows why we need global cooperation, because measles actually is interesting in that humans are the only known reservoir. And so if we had enough global cooperation, we're able to work on a targeted, concerted vaccine campaign, it might be a disease that we could potentially completely eradicate.
Well, we did have two cases from Houston recently, adult cases of measles. These are two unvaccinated adults. They traveled abroad, and then they came back and they were diagnosed as having measles. We also know that in general, that people who come to the United States who are undocumented, who are asylum seekers, are generally coming from countries where the vaccination rates are higher than in the United States. And that's typically because of the work of the World Health Organization and other international NGOs and things like that. But we have seen recently this month, there was a migrant shelter in Chicago where they did have a measles outbreak, but which was quickly contained because of the high number of people who had been vaccinated. So it's a mixed story.
It is a mixed story. I think really what this highlights, kind of come back to this same part of it, is that vaccines, when we look at public health interventions, are really one of the most cost-effective tools that we have available. And we should be obviously making sure that vaccines that we're utilizing are safe and effective, but we should also be making sure that we're effectively using them as widespread of a fashion as possible, as consistently as possible, to get as many people protected as possible to help reduce some of these pockets, these outbreaks that we're seeing.
And during the Biden administration, migrants who were seeking asylum, they were going through the system, they were all given the COVID vaccine. So there's that effort as well. I do want to point out that, let's go to another caller. We have Christian, and Christian, you're on the air. Go ahead.
So I want to speak frank about the current situation. And I think there's a lot of propaganda for the past 20 years started with healthy living, crunchy lifestyle, pushed it, you know, against vaccines. Now it's going to anti-immigration propaganda, and I don't think there's a lot of counter messaging. Like in the last caller, that's an example of a person who obviously has heard that propaganda and has repeated it.
So help me understand what you mean by crunchy lifestyle and propaganda. And I'm not really clear what, I don't even know which side you're on. So help me understand what you're talking about.
Oh, no, I'm pro vaccine. It is, you saw, like, you know, what would you call, like in the, not, you saw celebrities, you know, they have platforms who might promote anti-vaxxers, you know, that type of like healthy living, that type of, I guess I really, yeah.
All right. Kristen, I think I know where you're coming from. There's the sort of the raw whole milk people, and they want to have organic food, and they're cautioned, they're not comfortable with vaccines. And we see that that is an entry point for a lot of the conspiracy theories. But, you know, we're just trying to deal with the scientific facts as they have been laid out through the scientific process. And so, Jason Bowling, we know that vaccines are safe and effective, and they prevent the spread of terrible diseases. I mean, have we just forgotten that?
Well, I in a way, you almost wonder if vaccines are almost a victim of their own success, right? They've been so effective that we really haven't had to see a lot of our classmates, coworkers dealing with the sequelae of, you know, polio-induced paralysis or, you know, long-term health consequences because they had measles and they had encephalitis. Or if you look at some of the older generations before the vaccine was available, before 1963, they all knew somebody that was sick. They were sick themselves. They probably knew somebody that might have had a family member die from one of these infections. And so since we haven't had that proximity to that, I think that why we've become a little bit complacent with why we need to get these vaccines, why they're still important.
But we have a live example of what's happening right now in West Texas, where we have a population that has a very low vaccination rate and a outbreak of measles. And this isn't the first time this has happened. People seem to think of it as, well, I'd rather have a measles outbreak than have to deal with a government-required vaccination, even now.
I think we need to have ongoing kind of discussions like this, really, to kind of really try to tease out what people's concerns are. It's important for people to be informed as well. I think that's one of the challenges, is making sure that there's solid information that address benefits and risks, so that people feel comfortable with making decisions.
So news headline today, flu deaths have surpassed COVID deaths nationwide for the first time since the start of the pandemic, according to CDC data. And so we're now seeing that the number of influenza deaths are greater than COVID-19 deaths in the week ending of the 25th, January 25th. And I don't know if that means we're having a terrible flu or if COVID, I think COVID is becoming more easily spread but less lethal simultaneously. There's a lot going on there.
There is a lot going on. This respiratory virus season has been pretty complicated. I think you're right. I think part of it is this is a really bad flu season. And one of the strains that's predominant, this H3N2, when we've had historically bad flu seasons, H3N2 strains tend to be the driver for that. But just the number of flu cases has been really, really high this year, which would explain why we have more deaths. And the COVID numbers have been, while they're high, they're not as high as they've been in prior winters either. So there's been a little bit of a shift this year. And some of this, you know, we're continuing to learn how flu and COVID are going to have these complex interactions during respiratory virus seasons. We're seeing this year a little bit of a flip from what we've seen the prior years.
Let's go to another caller. Our number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR. Talk, and we have Carl. And Carl, you're on the air.
Hello.
Yeah.
My question is this. If there is a high vaccination rate of people who are immigrating into the U.S., how much of that is basically the result of USAID and efforts that the United States government did in health in other countries? Thank you. And I'll take my response off the air.
Well, Carl, thank you for that call. Well, when you say who's responsible, that can go back. How far upstream do we want to go in terms of scientific research and discovery and an education of local actors around the world? But so, Dr. Bowling, what do you think?
Well, I think we all recognize that we're all interconnected, right? And people living in countries across the globe can travel to the U.S. Within 24, 48 hours. And so we all have a vested interest in making sure that we keep people as healthy as possible. Now, the strategies for doing that are well beyond my scope, but they're important. We need to be using, again, we talked about how effective vaccines are as public health interventions. So really that's a strategy. We need to figure out how we can, we can obviously need to make sure we take care of the United States, but we need to be looking outside of the United States as well, because we know there's a lot of travel from people that live in the U.S. out and people that live outside the U.S. in. We all have a vested interest in making sure that people are healthy and vaccinated.
So we do have a flu vaccine that's available, and it's safe and proven effective. And we do know that flu season, since the flu season began on October 1st, there have been 3,262 deaths in Texas attributed to the flu or pneumonia, including 4 children. Flu continues to be and is a very deadly virus, and you can get the vaccine. You just walk over to your HEB pharmacy and tell them you want to be vaccinated, and they'll vaccinate you. You'll be vaccinated in 20 minutes and good to go home.
Absolutely. It's very frustrating to see. I don't know if we've just gotten too complacent with numbers of deaths in bad flu seasons, but if the flu vaccine is not as effective as the measles vaccine, so I think we need transparency in how it works, but it is effective in reducing the severe outcomes of disease, reducing the risk of ending up having to see a doctor or ending up in the hospital, the ICU, or dying from flu, even if you get flu after getting the vaccine. So I think we really need to highlight the importance of that, because we are losing too many Texans, too many people in the United States, too many people worldwide for influenza infections.
You know, doing all the reading to get ready for our conversation today, doctor, I was like going, man, I mean, should I be wearing my mask when I go out into public? I mean, the other day I had to go to an event, and there's all sorts of people there, and I'm going, well, just a couple of years ago, this would have been unheard of, but here we are back in mass and, back into super spreader seasons, I guess.
I think you're highlighting a really important point, and that's really, we should be looking at other strategies that help keep us healthy as well. And one of the things that comes down to the vaccines is no vaccine is 100%, and people sometimes use that as a reason they don't take it at all, but it doesn't mean it's not helpful. It's an important tool, but other things, like respiratory virus is really high. Everybody should do a risk assessment if they're at high risk for complications from flu, COVID, other infections. They should consider wearing a mask when they go to a crowded public indoor setting. It's just like when you drive in a car, you have a seatbelt, you have an airbag, you wouldn't want to take one of those out or just say, well, one of them is going to be 100%. You kind of use layers of strategies, and doing that is going to be more effective than any one of those interventions alone.
And what about the hand sanitizer and the hand washing? You know, we really got into that during the COVID years.
Yes, absolutely. Right. So hands, keeping your hands clean still remains a foundational benchmark for preventing infections. In the hospital and in the community, everywhere, there are a lot of diseases we don't have vaccines or treatments for, but you can prevent many of them by having clean hands before you eat. I think highlighting and educating people on the importance of hand hygiene is also very important.
And so here we are post-pandemic. We're still seeing COVID-19 cases out there. Texas is seeing an increase. We're seeing, according from the state numbers, a 50% rise in cases, a 78% increase in COVID-related deaths recently in the state of Texas. So this is a real thing still. It's just something that we have forgotten about, or just pops up now. It's just part of life.
I think it's part of life. I think there's some fatigue, but I think it's important that people remain aware, because there are still measures that people can take to reduce their risk of getting infected. We know that with these kind of, that people are not good overall in predicting when we're going to see increases in some of these infections. We have the typical respiratory virus season, but we've seen COVID high in the summer and other times outside of that. And so there's still a potential that we'll see COVID cases increase as we move into spring and summer. And people need to be aware of that so they take appropriate precautions, such as getting the COVID vaccine. And again, some of these other measures that we're talking about as well.
But the treatment of COVID, we have Paxlovid. There are things you can do to treat COVID. If you have the measles and the influenza, you basically just have to ride it out. But you can get treatment for COVID.
There is effective treatment for COVID, and that's really important, particularly for people that are at high risk for complications. And really, they should be approaching it. They should get the vaccine, obviously, because prevention is better than getting it. But we know that you can still get a breakthrough infection, in which case Paxlovid is a very effective antiviral. It also has been proven to reduce the risk of hospitalizations and deaths for people that are at high risk for COVID complications.
All right, we're going to take a break here. We'll come back. We want to talk about avian flu. We're also seeing numbers increasing for TB. What is happening with the Trump administration? This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Stay with us. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the spread of infectious diseases, and there's a lot going on right now in that area. We're speaking with Dr. Jason Bolling, University Health's Director of Hospital Epidemiology and Professor of Infectious Diseases at UT Health San Antonio. And Dr. Jason, you also see patients. What are you seeing with your patient load?
People that have respiratory infections, so flu, COVID, and some of them are actually presenting with something else, but they have flu and COVID. They're getting over it, or they just have some mild symptoms, and some people with more severe symptoms with those as right now. So definitely seeing a lot of flu.
So I guess you can, but I don't know what that would look like, and I'd hate for it to be me to find out. You get COVID and flu simultaneously?
We do see co-infections, yes. And then, so sometimes it's a little hard to tell because a PCR test can detect virus that was there previously. So you get that some by asking about prior symptoms, how long their symptoms have lasted. But we've seen people that have believable co-infections, and they can have more severe courses.
Well, by now, almost everyone has had COVID at least once. There are those NOVID people out there. But how protected are you if you already had COVID once or twice or three times? You've had a couple of vaccine jabs. Do you still need to keep up with the vaccine?
It is important to keep up with the vaccine. And so one of the challenges with the COVID vaccine, the biggest challenge is that many people aren't getting it. If you look at the national data with the uptake, it's about 15% of people are getting the most updated vaccine. But really the other challenge is it doesn't last for very long. And then there's changes in the strains of COVID as well, to where getting the newest vaccine gives you the most protection. I'll say that we've seen people that have had a prior mild case of COVID, and then their second case of COVID lands them in the hospital. And so there can be some variability, even from a person that's had it before. And so I think taking precautions to help reduce some of that variability for yourself or your family members, particularly if they're at higher risk for complications, is important.
So if I go get a COVID vaccine today, is that how new or fresh or up to date is that vaccine?
So the vaccine that's currently available, it still matches pretty closely with what's circulating now. The protection from that probably lasts around 6 months, which is why for people that are highly immunocompromised, they recommend that they get a second dose of the vaccine about 6 months later so that they have kind of a more durable protection. What we need is a COVID vaccine that lasts longer.
So, of course, when we first had to deal with COVID-19, it was a novel virus. No one had any immunity to it because it was a whole new thing. Is that kind of what we would be dealing with again if the avian flu became something in the human population, began to spread in the population?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it will kind of depend on what that strain that pops over, or spillover event, as it's called, from animals to people, how mutated that virus becomes in that spillover event. The more changes that it makes when it transfers over into human-to-human infection would impact how much immune cross protection we have from prior flu infections. But it potentially could be a novel infection that caused very severe disease.
So we're talking about right now, it is spreading in the bird population. I just got a release today about how the black vultures in the New Braunfels areas, they were spotted at Landa Park, dead black vultures, wild birds in the watershed, waterfowl, they're dying and they're just telling people to avoid these birds. I don't know who needs to hear this, but do not handle those birds. But it is showing that it is spreading in the bird population, and it is reason why the eggs are so expensive right now. But we've seen it now cross over occasionally into like dairy cattle, and then to maybe some humans who are working with the dairy cattle, and they're getting not a deadly virus infection, but they're, you know, they're getting something, and that's the concern, right?
Right, that's the concern, and it's been primarily with animal contacts. We're not seeing sustained person-to-person transmission, which is good, but the concern is that could shift. Currently, the symptoms have been largely mild for these the humans that get infected with close, you know, work with cattle primarily. Partly that's because of how this virus, it has tropism. It likes to go to the conjunctiva or the eyes and then the lower respiratory tract, but not the upper respiratory tract. There's some concern that it could have some shifts where it starts targeting the upper respiratory tract, and it might be easier, more easily transmitted from person to person.
So the issue is how well are we able to respond? We know that COVID became a political issue, and the administration that is now in charge, we've seen, President Trump give orders kind of locking down the CDC. He's interfering with information flow. Trump officials exerting unprecedented control over CDC scientific journals is one story that's out there. One health official told CBS News that they have lost their autonomy. It seems this is not good at a bad time.
Certainly agree that having ongoing access to information is important as it relates to flu activity. The CDC website still produces information. They're still providing updates to their flu map, flu view. I would say that what we do have for avian flu, which we didn't have for COVID, is that our test will detect flu A. It won't tell you the subtype, and so that part still needs to be improved upon. But at least it will tell you that you have a flu infection. And our flu antivirals are effective against avian flu right now as well. So we have a treatment, which is important. But obviously, we do need good information so that everybody's aware of where this is at. So we could detect if we do start to see human-human transmission, which is why there's been some efforts for requests for the hospitals to start sending flu A viruses that aren't subtyped to the health department so that they can help with some of that detection, so we can have some of that information, which, as you stated, I agree with, is really important.
Well, we know that the major strain that's happening with flu right now is strain A. It's easily to establish that. It's like the COVID test now. We're able to look at the little line on the little gizmo. What does that mean that it's strain A?
So in a typical flu season, we see flu A strains and flu B strains. There's actually subtypes of those as well. So in a flu A strain, the top two that are causing problems are in human infections right now are H3N2 and H1N1. The avian flu is an H5N1. And so the PCRs right now will just tell you flu A, but if it's not H3N2 or H1N1, it just says non-typable. And so there's some need to improve some of the access to testing that would be a little more specific so we can detect when we start seeing more cases of avian influenza.
Now, there is this norovirus that is going around. It is commonly referred to as the stomach flu. And I don't think it's, fatal, but it certainly makes you feel like it's fatal. I mean, it's pretty awful.
It is very miserable for people that have had it. It's the virus that people associate with cruise ship outbreaks, because that's one of the more popular places where it gets identified, and people that have experienced it remember it. The symptoms, fortunately, are self-limited and only last for about 2 to 3 days, but people that have it are very miserable with a lot of nausea and vomiting and some diarrhea as well.
Right, and so preventive measures include proper hand hygiene and avoiding the consumption of contaminated food or water. This common sense stuff, but there is no real other treatment other than just ride it out.
Yeah, that's right. So supportive care, hydration, so really prevention is key. And so The cruise ship industry obviously takes a big hit when they from the stigma of norovirus infection. So they've really ramped up environmental cleaning and trying to help with some of in providing hand hygiene. But even with all of that, there's still periodic outbreaks.
And, you know, people who get this should not be going to work, particularly if you're working in the food industry. And unfortunately, many of the people who do work in the food industry and have to go to work when they're sick because they have no choices. They have no sick leave.
So this is another really important intervention that people can take. We're talking about, you know, the different measures that we can layer on to prevent some of these infections. And staying home when you're ill is a key to that. And then when you're better and return to work, determining what kind of, depending on the type of work you do, you may need to modify your duties. So absolutely, you should not be doing food preparation if you're recovering from a GI illness because of the risk of still being able to transmit infection to others.
And so we haven't had anything happening in Texas with TB of note. We've seen in Kansas a TB outbreak. But this is, you know, used to be a scourge, and it's still a thing.
It is. And globally, TB causes a huge number of infections, responsible for a lot of deaths worldwide. We have, fortunately, through a lot of hard work and public health interventions, been able to decrease problems that we had in TB. We had a huge problem with TB in the United States as well. And so we've made improvements in that, but that also is a potential jeopardy if we don't maintain the progress that we've made so far.
Well, TB is a bacterial infection that primarily affects the lungs and is spread through the air when an infected person coughs or sneezes. But, you know, it's just so hard to eradicate once a person becomes infected, particularly if we have antibiotic-resistant TB.
That's right. So treatment of active TB is very complicated, requires multiple medications for a prolonged period of time. Here in the United States, we have the resources to perform directly observed therapy, which means you take your medicine so someone watches you take them to make sure that they finish the entire course. But what we really need to focus on is treating people that have what's called latent TB infection. So you get exposed to TB, it's usually not till even years later that you develop active TB, but you can treat TB at that point with less medication, with one pill, and eradicate it so that they don't later develop reactivation of that kind of dormant hibernating TB infection.
We're taking a break here. Our phone lines are open. If you got a question or a comment about the infectious diseases that are happening right now, that are spreading around us, what are you doing to protect yourself, protect your family? Give us a call, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Source continues after this. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. With me on the line is Dr. Jason Bowling, University Health Director of Hospital Epidemiology, Professor of Infectious Diseases at UT Health San Antonio. Our phone lines are open. If you've got a question or a comment about the spread of infectious diseases right now, we know we have the measles spreading, influenza, COVID-19, all the other little baddies are out there, RSV. Got a question, give us a call, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Jason Bowling, we did, maybe about a year ago, we were really concerned about the spread of RSV. It was a respiratory disease that impacted infants and elderly people. What's happening there?
I think the exciting news in the RSV front is that we now have some therapies to help prevent infections. We have the vaccine available for older adults, and we have actually information now, data that shows that it's actually very effective. It's helpful in preventing older adults from being hospitalized. We also have a long-acting antibody that you can give babies that are born to protect them during that first 6 months of life, especially is when they're at highest risk of getting RSV infection and having severe complications like not being able to breathe. You can also vaccinate the mother during the third trimester, and when the baby is born, they will have antibodies from the mom when they're born, so they're protected at birth during that, again, that vulnerable time period, 0 to 6 months.
You know, we have these conspiracy theories. We say, oh, we have vaccines for that. We can help you avoid getting these terrible diseases. And yet we run into the conspiracy theories. And one of them is now, you know, Bobby Kennedy Jr., who will soon be in charge of medical science in the United States or whatever his job's going to be, it seems like the people who understand that vaccinations are important, they're safe, they save lives, they're the vast, vast, super vast majority of Americans. Yet we're allowing people who don't understand that to be the shot callers, and they're going to be impacting all of our health choices. I mean, is it possible that they could stop me from getting a vaccine that I want? Will they take the COVID vaccine off the market?
I'm not aware of any movements to remove vaccines. I think what's going to be important, there may be more freedoms for people to decline vaccines potentially. And so I think it's going to be inherent that we provide credible information and regular information to people about the benefits of vaccines, and then transparency about what they do and don't do. There's ongoing monitoring of vaccines for side effects, things like that we need to make people aware of, and then also highlight some of the risks and problems. Why are we seeing so many outbreaks? What is the biggest risk factor? What's the connecting dot there, connecting line? If the connecting line is we're having unvaccinated people are at higher risk, we need to make sure that we emphasize that so people realize there are potential side effects for any medication or vaccine, but there's certainly side effects and consequences from having a viral infection or a bacterial infection as well.
We have people in a population that can't be vaccinated because their immune system is compromised or for other reasons, and we just can't protect them because we're no longer going to have community or herd immunity. Let me go to Abraham, who's on the line. And Abraham, you're on the air. Abraham, you there?
OBGYN doctor, yes. But I have a comment regarding how you prevent the diseases. The federal government or state government should provide free vaccine for immigrants from southern border. If they don't, the spread of disease is not going to stop. That I hope you consider that. Thank you.
Well, Abraham, thank you for that. The idea of giving immigrants who are coming across the southern border free vaccines, that is a noble and it is a positive idea. I don't know if our government is going to be on board. They'd rather just not have them come across the border. That's their solution. But Dr. Bowling?
So I think it raises an important point, and we kind of touched on it earlier, in that vaccines, again, are a very cost-effective intervention. Certainly healthcare is really challenging to provide, particularly after somebody's infected. And so the more that we, as a healthcare system, really for all conditions, even outside infections, look at more prevention, I think we'll see that we can be more cost-effective. Vaccines would certainly be the best example, and preventing infection certainly more cost-effective than treating it. And if you could prevent secondary cases by preventing an infection, there's obvious benefits there. But really, preventative measures in other areas makes a lot of sense, too, so that we can make sure that we're making the most out of the limited healthcare resources that we have.
All right, I have another caller, and let's go to Penny. And Penny, you're on the air. Go ahead, Penny.
Hello, gentlemen. Thank you for this really important topic. Doctor, I had a positive TB test 30 years ago and took rifampin for 6 months and was told that that was it. I was okay. And I just heard you mention about a pill that you can take if you have latent TB. So I was really curious about that.
So, I mean, you are cured, but you think you have latent TB? I don't understand.
Well, I was told at the time that a positive TB means you've been infected. I took the treatment that I was supposed to through the health center. And then I was told that it was now called latent TB, that I had an inactive infection that would only come to fruition if I ever had an immunocompromised state.
All right, Penny, thank you for that. So Dr. Bowling?
Yes, so that is right. So that's fantastic. So you're right. So most people that are exposed to someone that has TB in their body, the majority of people actually don't go into active infection. Instead, they go into this latent TB infection that she's mentioning, to where it's lying dormant, but the risk remains that years later, something happens to your immune system, you develop a medical condition, or as you get older, it could reactivate and cause active disease. When it's in this latent hibernating state, you can actually take one medicine, and rifampin is one that is effective. And you can get by eradicating it with just taking one medicine, versus if it reactivates, that's where you have to take this more complex regimen of four pills for several months.
And why don't more people know that? I mean, it seems like a lot of people are in that boat.
I think that is an important message that needs to be disseminated and spread more, because prevention, as we were talking about just minute ago is really key. And if we can prevent more reactivations, we can reduce the risk of future outbreaks.
Well, we know that scientific research has been, you know, capable, has brought all these things to our fore. We have them. But now we're seeing a President Trump order telling the universities and other institutions doing medical research that they're going to lose out on billions of dollars in federal funding. He has changed the rules on how the National Institute of Health allocates grants. And this is going to be, they're having to stop research at universities, medical schools, research hospitals. What are you hearing about what the impact of this order?
I think there's still a lot being sorted out with what the impact is going to be. I don't have any additional information. I think a lot of this has happened recently. There's a lot of ongoing discussion, which is going to be really important. I think the important thing is to highlight what those impacts could be now and down the road as well, so that there's a full understanding and clarity about what these measures could cause.
Yeah. So we're trying to figure that out. Everything is, there's so much uncertainty about the orders. They come out, they don't really, they sound absolute, and then we start trying to explore them and we find out that they don't mean what they really mean, but they actually do. I mean, do we know this is impacting research in San Antonio?
I think at this point, people are still kind of exploring what the impacts could be and then looking into what measures would need to be taken depending on the different scenarios that could come to fruition because of this. So I think there's still a lot of investigation and discussion about what potential options or alternatives are available.
I want to circle back to talking about the measles outbreak that we have in West Texas, Gaines County. It's you know, hundreds of miles away from here, still in Texas. We know this is spreading. At least 24 cases have been confirmed so far. Every day, we're seeing bigger numbers. Should we take some sort of relief in the fact that they are it is hundreds of miles away, but, you know, we still are in Texas. There is a lot of contact between San Antonio, Bexar County, and, you know, West Texas. What should we be thinking about?
Well, I think that's an important thing for people to keep in mind, is that just because something's not happening in our backyard doesn't mean that we couldn't see some sequelae of it or some consequences.
Well, it kind of is our backyard, though.
It is. And people drive to and from in a weekend, right, to West Texas, or even in a single day. So I think what everybody can do is make sure that they're up to date on their vaccines and make sure that they're taking measures to keep themselves protected.
Well, the fact that we have such lax laws allowing these exemptions for vaccinations, I mean, that is part of the political process of Texas. I mean, should we be standing up and saying, look, we're looking at the consequences of bad public health policies?
Yeah, so the national average for exemptions for vaccines is around 3.2%, and Texas is at 2.3%. So we're less than the national average, actually. It has increased in Texas, and it's increased nationally. So I think this is a national trend. I think we probably all need to, like, across the United States, work together and look at why is this happening, and what other interventions can we use to try and provide information so people can make good, informed decisions.
Well, measles is so contagious, and we know that when the vaccination rates fall below 95%, as they here in Gaines County, you could just predict that this is a situation that will occur. So when you say, why is this happening? We know why this is happening, because people aren't getting vaccinated.
We do, and that is, we remain at risk of many vaccine-preventable diseases becoming losing elimination status in the United States for many vaccine-preventable diseases, which can have significant consequences for people.
We are falling backwards. Dr. Jason Bolling, University Health Director of Hospital Epidemiology, Professor of Infectious Diseases at UT Health San Antonio. Thanks for coming on the air today, talking to us, helping us understand what's happening with all these infectious outbreaks that are happening across the state. Appreciate that.
Thank you, David.
That's The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thank you for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted and produced by David Martin Davies. Technical support by Steve Short, Ruben Garcia, and Yvette Benavides. Dan Katz is TPR's Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.